And Jackson again. I mean, just able to completely shut down LSU. Jake Marciano was masterful. He wasn't dominant. Didn't get a lot of K's. But I mean, he limited
the ball in the park and tested his defense.
Limited LSU to four hits and a walk. I mean, that's all he gave up in six innings, which was more than I expected him to go. Butch Thompson had said, you know, they're watching his pitches. But he was outstanding. And turned things over. Got a little dicey in the ninth.
Sure.
When ABS, which has become a huge topic, came into play. And if the balls were where the computer showed they were, there's no question they were balls. But it sure didn't look like it.
Didn't look like it when
they crossed the plate.
Didn't look like it when they crossed the plate for sure. And you know, I know that's been a topic of conversation. I've been a fan of ABS in MLB. You know, I've long thought that was a good way to do it. I mean, we went to the All-Star game last year in Truist, and that was they did ABS in that game to be like, hey, this is going to happen here soon. Get ready for it. And I thought it was great. I mean, it was my first experience watching it, and I thought it was fantastic. So, I mean, I'm hoping more and more baseball leagues get into that mode, and obviously college baseball.
All for it if a strike is a strike.
Yeah.
I mean,
I
still don't understand why they decided to add a buffer of an inch on either side and stretch the top and bottom of the zone.
Now I'm not 100% sure when the thing in MLB is that they measured everybody to kind of have like
they supposedly did that for the SEC tournament.
And I wonder how precise that is compared to, you know, all the data that obviously goes into it on the Major League Baseball side.
And when we were watching games before Auburn took the field, I thought that the more striking thing was inside and outside pitches on the zone, like the inside and outside of the plate being called strikes on the ABS that looked kind of suspicious. In the Auburn game, I thought it was the height of the strike zone. Like there were a couple of low pitches that get overturned early on. Like I thought that it was the more striking thing was, at least early on, was like, wow, that pitch seemed like it was, I mean, there was one, I know Brad talked about one being at the guy's shins that was overruled and called a strike early on.
Well, I mean, they supposedly expanded it both ways, but didn't expand it. In the ninth inning, it wasn't as expanded. It didn't appear. Jackson Sanders, I mean, had a couple of pitches. He had two called strike threes that turned into ball fours and made it really interesting there before Auburn able to put it away.
I just don't think you can let it change your approach too much because that's how it's going to be called. Right, and so you need to
for this week.
Yeah, you need to adjust, and you wonder with the strike zone initiative, you wonder how often these strikes could be strikes in the college world. Like, you don't know how often they're going to be called strikes in the postseason. You know, the idea is that this is adjusting for human error in the strike zone to a degree with the larger than usual gray areas. Right? Is that
I think they need to cut down on the gray. If they cut down on the gray, Then maybe it'll be okay. It was odd, though. I mean,
you think ball and strike is a black and white?
It should
sort
be.
Of again. Like
I mean, the corner of the plate is that's the edge of the strike zone.
Well, the gray. How about this?
What I didn't like last night is there were a couple of times when the ball barely touched the buffer, the outside of the buffer zone, which made it 2 inches off the plate, and that's not a strike.
I would almost say if you lack the specifics that baseball has, like Major League Baseball has been able to, you know, the nuances of this system through the preparation they had before they implemented it. Without that, maybe the gray area should be like inconclusive, right? You say like, hey, the ABS can't tell if this is a ball or a strike right now. And so we're going to go with the umpire's call.
Man, we'd see for the first time, we'd see some real blowups there with coaches going crazy.
Well, sure. I mean, but in the gray area that you're talking about, like it specifically, like if that's where the ball touches, then maybe we just go with the umpire's call. And we say like, all right, well, we lack the detail right now to tell if this ball was indeed a ball or a strike. So maybe we shouldn't let the computer
They're not going to admit they lack the detail of doing that. I mean,
do they seem like balls and strikes right now, watching the way ABS calls
most
it?
Of them, no. Most of them, no.
So would you agree that they lack the detail?
Oh, yes. I they're lacking something. but fortunately, I don't think it's really had a huge impact on the games.
I think that's important.
It slowed a couple of them down, but yeah, an outstanding game last night as Auburn. I think that solidifies Auburn as a top eight national seed. Was talking with Ben this morning, and then with Doug again earlier today. You know, just wondering though, with Auburn and Texas A&M both being listed as teams that could be in the 6, 7, or 8 mm-hmm. position, could the loser of that ball game still be a little nervous going into Monday?
I think Auburn or A&M being like going from quarterfinals of the SEC in the regular season they had to being at 9 would be
yeah, but A&M's 9 on some people's yeah, list.
Maybe not with A&M.
They haven't played a game yet. Yeah. See, that's the thing. This will be their first game in the tournament.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think it may be more important to A&M tomorrow than Auburn.
With the win last night, I think it would be officially a surprise if Auburn fell out of the top 8.
I agree.
On Monday. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been a surprise anyway, but maybe not as now it would be a shock, right? Like for Auburn to – I mean, if Auburn were to lose to A&M and they decide, all right, well, Auburn's the 9 seed or the 10 seed. I mean, people had Auburn at 3. You know, there are places
going into the Georgia series.
Justin, do you notice that when they tinker with – because the amount ABS is – you know, the attention ABS has gotten this week. Do you think like it's whenever a conference decides to experiment with something in the conference tournament – that thing can get an inordinate amount of attention, and I think
the story of the tournament.
Yeah. Think about the Big 12 trying the plexiglass court with in basketball, and then quickly reversing course in time for the semifinals because the players were like, "Well, this doesn't perform like a basketball court."
It's natural. I mean, it's the narrative, obviously. Whenever. I think that's just human nature to be the case.
But I like ABS. I'm under the impression you think it's a pretty good system, too, yeah. Especially when the science
is
there.
I find it interesting you get 3.
You get 3, but every one you get right, you get another one. That's why LSU was 6-for-6 last night.
Yeah,
and Missouri went 9-for-10 in the first game.
Yeah, I like the –
Auburn, on the other hand, was you're out.
Yeah, I like MLB's format of getting 2. And if you just keep getting them, you keep them going. Because I think if you have 3, especially early on, you can be a little bit more.
Yeah, you can take a chance.
You can
early.
Take chances more. 2, it's like, you know, you'll see some guys kind of think, okay, do I really want to get us only down to 1? And once you get down to 1, you kind of
better get it right.
Yeah, and once you get down to 1, you see teams kind of save it for later in the game before they really pull the trigger on it. I think 3 might be you get a little too liberal with it. And also, like, these are college umpires. Mm-hmm. These aren't MLB umpires, so like when you hear things like LSU going 6-for-6 and Missouri going 9-for-10, it's like, yeah, like they're probably going to be more missed calls in the college level just because of your level of umpire is a little different.
Again, a lot of them though. I mean, the complaints that I heard after the game last night were the pitches didn't look to your eye when you're watching the pitch, Jackson Sanders' pitches didn't look like they missed as much as they showed on the computer, because I thought that's pretty close, but it may be a ball. I understood them challenging it, but boy, the challenge made it look like he missed by a mile.
Well, yeah, the rare occasion where when the system isn't bulletproof, you can suddenly start to think, well, maybe the human umpire got that one right. Like, who knows? They just showed the top 8. I think it was D1 Baseball's projection of it
Have Auburn 7
during the SEC broadcast. They have Auburn 7, A&M 8. I do wonder if you had the combination of an A&M victory tomorrow and maybe somebody other than UCLA or Georgia Tech or North Carolina winning their conference tournament, would that give the committee something to think about if I don't know, Florida State or Southern Miss were to win their conference tournament this week. Couple that with, like, would that make it a bake-off between the loser of that Auburn A&M game and that team for the final 8th spot?
I think it's silly. I mean, you'd have to be like coin toss for me to think that tournament results should get. I mean, How many games do these teams play?
Top 10 teams playing.
Coming up on game 50.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming up on game 60.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's a 56-game regular season. Everybody lost a couple, so it's 52
or 3 going
in.
And in college basketball, you know, conference tournaments really don't matter for seeding at all, and there's less data to go off of.
I think it's just something that people can talk about and be worried about or whatever.
I think there's
I don't think there's really much that's going to be –
I think your body of work is what it is.
I think it's also a reaction to the SEC maybe getting five of the eight regional teams, too, or five of the eight super regionals, where it's like, is there a path for a team to maybe make that four, and who would be the SEC team left out if that were to happen? Probably either Alabama, Auburn, or Texas
A&M. Yeah, those are teams that are six, seven, and eight. And Florida is a team that that feels like if they can get to Sunday or win the SEC tournament, that they deserve a top eight seed. Florida's a team's really been playing well here down the stretch.
I think Auburn's metrics are going to be too strong to get knocked out, especially now that you're not going one and done in Hoover.
Right. Well, Florida, Alabama's a team that Florida could mess up since they're playing them today, and it's Alabama's first game. So
yeah.
And I think Southern Miss and Florida State's metrics are pretty good for a team outside the top eight projections right now. Florida State's right behind Auburn in strength of schedule, stuff like that. Nebraska would potentially be one of those teams too, because they're a highly regarded top 16. I've seen Nebraska at 11 or 12 in these things. Generally, I think you guys are right that we have enough.
I mean, like, you can't even say, what would you be basing it off of? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, like, you can't even. Say now at this point with them avoiding the sweep against Georgia and then beating LSU.
They played better against Georgia than anybody else has over the last month.
It's like you can't even say, they were kind of scuffling down the stretch.
No.
And that's now you can't really say that anymore. I just tend to believe like these tournaments are going to really do nothing but maybe shuffle the order slightly.
I think
who's in is in.
I think with an Auburn win, A&M's case for a top eight is a little bit flimsier because the underlying numbers aren't where they are with Auburn. Now, they did win one more conference game than Auburn did. But, like, you look – if it's a bake-off between Auburn, Alabama, and A&M for those final three spots in Super Regionals, you're probably talking about, it's like two teams that have top three strength of schedules in Auburn and Alabama, and then an A&M team that has a strength of schedule, I think, outside the top 25. And so it's maybe a little bit easier to – for the committee to
and
decide.
Then you can look at head-to-head at that point, and you know, Auburn going and beating that A&M team on the road in that series would definitely help.
And if Auburn were to beat A&M tomorrow, like maybe – and again, Florida State to me is the team that would potentially – I guess USC would be the other Big Ten team that because they're really good in the – because their computer numbers are top 10 RPI. These are top 10 RPI teams.
How really would they be able to jump the –
if they're
the
not ahead of them right
schedule.
Now,
yes.
Right,
that's
why,
right.
Why would,
wouldn't they have to beat like a UCLA?
I would think.
I think it would take.
They're not
going
to get.
That.
Yeah, they're not going to get to play the level of competition that these SEC teams still are. The ones that are still alive.
Well,
are playing.
To win the conference tournament, Justin's right. SC would probably have to go through Nebraska and UCLA.
Yes.
Florida State would have to go through UNC and Georgia Tech.
I think you would have to beat those teams head to head straight up.
I still don't know if that would guarantee it.
And you know what? Sometimes
make it for a fun, conversation on Monday.
And Justin's noticed this before too. Sometimes the brackets seem finished already in these situations, right? Like this thing might be.
As someone who doesn't cover college baseball, I'm approaching this from a purely basketball perspective. Of this stuff does not matter.
No.
Like
this bracket,
especially with the Sunday. Way, especially with the way the baseball tournament unveils itself. Where on Sunday they'll tell you the top 16,
right?
And then the rest of the field. I mean, if they're doing that, like this thing's done and dusted.
Yeah,
I think.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they can adjust 17 through 32 if they want.
Like I think at this point you're not sitting here saying, "Is this team a top eight? Is this team a top 16?" It's like, okay, is that the five or the six? Is that the six?
Right.
You know, so that's going to be the one, I think.
But we have gotten surprises before where it's like, oh, we thought that team was six or seven and in pretty good position. Surprise, they're nine or ten. And so
last year was a surprise that Auburn was four.
Right. So if and if that were to happen, I didn't mention Georgia, that's the thing.
I think Auburn's better this year than they were a year ago.
Because we're talking about five SEC teams in the top eight. Is Georgia one of those? I mean, it's Georgia
is the top seed.
Georgia, Texas,
and then come
the three other SEC teams:
Alabama, Auburn, and Texas A&M.
Georgia's computer numbers are a little bit shakier, but they won the league away.
So dominant,
Justin. There's no as solid a season as Butch has had. Like to take nothing away from the work of Butch Thompson or Schlossnagel at Texas, Bama's coach,
yes,
deserves kudos. A&M's coach, they're maybe the biggest over, they're one of the bigger overachievers in the league.
The biggest overachiever is Georgia.
And the biggest, and yeah. for a team picked ninth or tenth in preseason in the conference to win the league going away, feels like coach of the year is pretty easy in that situation. Justin, I know it's more of a college basketball thing, but like when there's a team in the SEC in the preseason poll that when there's a team that greatly outperforms their preseason expectations, usually that's a safe candidate to be like one of the coach of the year choices, if not the coach of the year. And Wes Johnson is that at Georgia this year, where it's like they were picked outside the top half of the conference in the preseason. They won the league going away.
Yeah, this one's as easy as it gets right here, I think, when it comes to who's going to win that title. But yeah, I mean, I think for Auburn, you just, you know, keep swinging.
Keep pitching. That's the thing. They've got their pitchers set here for the next couple of games.
And they, you know, they play,
if they get that far.
And they play A&M, right, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like, they hit A&M really well in College Station, so that's got to be a really, really good feeling heading in. You know, even if you didn't have your best offense, you were going up against an absolute ace last night, still get a win. Who knows? You might be able to kind of turn back the clock a little bit.
And A&M's Friday night starter, who I imagine would be the guy tomorrow because it's their first game of the tournament, I think that like Auburn shelled him.
Yes.
It was one of his worst starts of the season at College Station because that was the game that was moved to the doubleheader on Saturday.
Yeah.
And then he had to pitch first half of that doubleheader, and it was a big second inning.
Second game, I mean, is when you saw the left. I was thinking they're going to throw the lefty.
I wonder if I would consider it now that you know.
Fastball.
You don't want to read too much into one performance like that, but like.
When it's that impressive on the road, I don't know. All right, so Georgia wins the opener today, 5-3. Alabama and Florida are scoreless in the bottom of the third. Those are the two games on tap today. You may be wondering, wait a minute, those games were only supposed to just be getting started. They moved those up because of the threat of weather. Mm-hmm. Could do the same thing tomorrow. For the two games, of course, Auburn is playing the second game right now. It's scheduled for 7, but it could be a mid-afternoon game tomorrow, just depending on how they look at the weather. We're just underway here on the Thursday Drive. Bill, Dan, Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer. We'll get to our first break. Love for you to join us, 334-321-1390. That's the Drive Hotline, sponsored by Skybar, as we get to our first break here on the Thursday Drive.
The Drive. The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck. At 888-382-7502 or email us at thedrive@espnau.com.
Welcome back into the Thursday Drive. I turned my head. Did Florida hit a homer? Because they've scored in the top of the fourth.
Is that why all the fans are leaving?
No. I think it's raining. Here's the rain. That's the reason they moved these games up. Yeah, look, I thought the camera got foggy all of a sudden. No, that's rain. Yeah, it is raining pretty hard. Yeah,
fans are streaming out of the venue. I'm like, well, it's just 1-0, Bill. I mean, it's not.
It's over. That's Bama fans. They've given up. Mm-hmm. No. Oh, my goodness.
Did you see the kid from Arkansas hit that homer yesterday?
Thor?
The one that went over the shed in right field.
Hulk Hogan?
He had a couple of homers that were like a total of 900 feet last night.
I imagine a guy with long blonde hair these days would probably prefer Thor to Hulk Hogan, right?
I would think that's
the nickname.
Or just in general.
Let me tell you something, dude.
That was, and it's the thing. I don't watch a ton of college baseball, so it is funny having to like re-engineer my brain whenever I see that like kid hits that homer, and it's like exit velo was like 119 off the bat. I was like, good lord! I was like, well, he's using a metal bat, but still, I mean, that's still hitting it hard.
It's hitting it very hard. It does help a little bit when you have metal for it to jump off of instead of wood. But yeah, there have been some bombs in this. In this tournament, I mean, I know that they're ahead of pace.
There was one.
Yep, that's what I missed. I turned around and looked, and Florida was up 1-0.
Batter's center,
right over the
dead
pitch clock.
Center, yeah,
right over the shot clock.
So Florida's up 1-0. Auburn had a couple of homers last night. Chase Frehlich with an oppo bomb, and then Eric Guevara. And I wondered, how do they know that was the longest flying time-wise.
Oh, they can tell all this
ball
now.
That was hit in the SEC this year. No, they proclaimed that last night. I went, okay, because they looked it up and there were over 1,400 homers hit by SEC team, by SEC
And that one was in the air the longest?
Yes, they said
I guess everybody has TrackMan.
6.2 seconds before it hit the ground.
Wow.
For Guevara's homer. That is a long time.
That's a pretty good punt.
Yeah, no kidding. Great hang time.
How do they measure that, like, hit the ground, like, what it would be if it would have hit back to surface level? Because if you hit it in the stands in the outfield, it technically doesn't hit the ground.
We simulate everything at Ebbets Field, right? And so it's like, all right, well, what would it have hit the ground?
Polo grounds.
Yeah, we simulate everything.
Simulate it like you're just in an open field.
That's right.
But I think that's what a lot of that does. Iowa. There's a lot of that, like when there's it's like, a ball went so many feet. Well, they don't necessarily know.
They project it to go.
Hit it at this exit velocity at this angle. Here's what the wind's doing right now. Here's what the altitude is.
It would have gone there.
Well, that one went 450.
The one that just got hit.
The one that just got hit. What we were talking about. Watch this.
I'm telling you, the Gators. Look out for the Gators right now. You know, we talked.
That one just flew by our window here at the studio.
This is even more dramatic than, you know, Auburn fans. A lot of people have talked about, well, Auburn has struggled offensively. And I pointed out they really haven't struggled offensively. Auburn has had some games where against top pitching, they haven't scored a lot of runs. But Auburn has been one of the better hitting teams in the SEC this year. Florida has not. Florida has been a poor hitting team this year whose pitching has been really, really good. But that dude just turned around on one.
Yeah, that dude just took out a windshield, right? Like that ball's in the parking lot.
Speaking of which,
that's a Pete Alonso kind of bomb right there.
Speaking of which, I don't know. I'll find the video of it in the commercial break if y'all haven't seen it yet. Did you see? So Jesus Mate is the new number one prospect in baseball. He's with the Brewers system, so he's playing for the Shuckers right now. They were in Montgomery last week. He hit a homer over the right field fence at Riverwalk. And if you've ever been to Riverwalk, you know you've got that curve wall, that picnic area. There's some trees, and there's a parking lot behind that. And he hit it over the first line of cars in the parking lot. That's like he hit it over the fence. He hit it over the picnic area. Yeah. He hit it over the tree.
He hit it to where
it went over a truck. Like you can see it fly over the front of a windshield.
He hit it to where you did your reception after your wedding, right?
Yeah. Like that. Yeah, he hit it. Yeah, he almost hit it to Painted George's over at the museum. Like he got a hold of it. And that kid's crazy.
Yeah,
because he's
a kid, right?
19.
He's 19. He just turned 19, and he's in Double A and this like switch hitting crazy phenom shortstop. So. But yeah, that one right there. I say that to say this: that one that Florida just hit, that went into the parking lot at the Met too. Like he got a hold of it.
You used to think, I mean, that's a tough place to hit a homer.
Sure,
because it is a bigger ballpark than a lot of SEC ballparks.
I mean, he hit that one 442, and it was like it wasn't like it was way over the fence, but it was a decent piece.
Yeah, so Florida's up 2-0 over Alabama as the Tide comes to bat in the bottom half of the fourth inning. We're about halfway through with hour number one. We got a lot we can get to as well.
Yeah, I mean we've got some recruiting news heating up. I know Justin, it's not necessarily like boots on the ground recruiting is not your forte, but I thought you had some really interesting observations about like Golish's philosophy and sort of the way he's embraced traditions. And I'd love to get into some of that with Bill.
Sure.
Because I think it's the point that I think some folks expected recruiting to fall off a cliff after Hugh Freeze because Hugh Freeze was such a great recruiter that without him, like, what are you going to do? And the example that we've pointed to where Jimbo Fisher was an excellent recruiter, A&M and Florida State didn't fall off a cliff recruiting without Jimbo Fisher services. I think Alex Golish has shown, he's embraced what I think a lot of folks were hoping for from that aspect of his tenure so far.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any question. So, yeah, we'll talk about that and more. Again, love for you to join in here on the Thursday Drive.
email The Drive at ESPNAU.com.
Welcome back into the Thursday Drive. Bill, Dan, Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer. Ferg, what all's going on with the Observer? Yeah. What will folks find?
Yeah,
and
so
what you got coming up?
We got it's busy right now, as you might expect. So let's see. Today, usually I do the mailbag on Friday, put the mailbag out early today because tomorrow we've got a story, an Auburn baseball story going out tomorrow morning. We got a podcast that will roll out this weekend as well, heading into your holiday weekend. So if you're going to be traveling or anything like that, we'll have the podcast out for y'all. And then throughout the week, let's see, we've had did a story earlier this week on Deshaun Spencer and just kind of digging into just how real how real could the hype be around him, mm-hmm. especially with the spring he had. I found out, very interestingly enough, in each of his three seasons at USF, Alex Gullish had one true freshman wide receiver have at least 20 catches and 200 yards in the season. And Spencer looks like the best candidate if they want to roll that in there.
That hasn't been extremely common for Auburn.
No, because I looked this up as well. If you had 20 catches and 200 yards in a season at Auburn, if a freshman receiver does that, he's automatically one of the top 11 freshman receivers ever at Auburn. Mm-hmm. And you just had two of that top 11 a couple of years ago with Cam Coleman and Malcolm Simmons. Also did a story this week.
It feels like with Spencer, it does feel like, I mean, unless the rotation sort of is larger than it's been historically for Golish, like it could be Spencer against Bryce Kane for some of those inside receiver reps. Like that's maybe an oversimplification. Neptune's going to be in the mix too.
Oh, yeah.
But it feels like there's six receivers that, you know, is a six receiver rotation, three starters, three backups, and the backups play.
Yeah, it's hard to play more than two deep.
Yeah, and so
he's had every year at USF. He had, or I guess every year, including the Tennessee years as well. Six receivers had that 20 mm-hmm. catches, 200 plus yards. So that's kind of what your rotation is going to look like.
And that could be what the four guys coming over from USF, you know, feel like safer bets to be four of those six in Nimrod, Singleton, Neptune, and Coger. And then you're maybe talking about holdovers like Bryce Kane and Duke Smith against true freshmen like Brian Williams Jr. and Deshaun Spencer.
I think Brian Williams has got a little tougher road just because they're more outside proven guys outside.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So, story on that. I also did a story this week. Went to
although Duke's not proven. I mean,
I wouldn't count him as proven.
Yeah,
no.
To battle. I mean, if his primary competition is Duke
Coger
Smith,
and Singleton. I mean, yeah. You know.
Can I continue? All right. The other story I did this week was I went on Monday to the charity golf event that the Bruce Pearl, the Family Foundation, mm-hmm. does. Talked to Stephen Pearl a good bit about the depth that Auburn's got in basketball and just kind of the shift. I had known last season Auburn did not play very deep on their bench. They had a very small rotation. Did not realize until I was doing the story, Auburn – there were 365 teams in D1 last year. They were 345th in using their bench mm-hmm. last wow. season, and how big of a drop-off that was from years past. Now you look at this roster where you've got like two deep at every position, at least with some overlap and some carryover elsewhere. So kind of digging into why Auburn should be deeper this year, why that was a big focus of their roster rebuild, and you know, some interesting insight from Stephen Pearl on how that could change the way Auburn plays. Because they wanted to kind of get back to what made them strong during the best years under Bruce Pearl, which is go deep so you can play faster on both ends of the floor.
It's harder to get after somebody defensively if you don't have much bench.
And they spent all last offseason mm-hmm. talking about, hey, we got to press. We got to get in people's grill because we don't have the size. We don't have the rim protection that we used to. Well, guess what? You can't do that when you don't have as many players.
No, we only got six players.
We were talking about that the first week of conference play, right, where it was like Georgia and A&M and Auburn had some defensive issues in both of those games, and it was like, it seems like you can either play to Tahad and Kevin Overton 35 minutes a game each,
yeah.
or you can ratchet up the pressure defensively, but you probably can't do both.
Can't do both,
And for Auburn this year, it does feel like, even though I would expect Tahad and Kevin to play heavy minutes,
He was saying like 30-32 makes a bigger difference than playing a guy 34-36, which by the end of the season they were playing all that and then some.
And I do feel like this time last year, Auburn was probably thinking they were going to be able to lean on their depth more in the 25-26 season. But between Aporum and Bashir and Simon Walker, and I guess Magwood not really panning out, like there were some there were some wrenches thrown in the plan last year.
But, I mean, like, you can look at now with Auburn, you could say you have 11 or 12 guys you feel like could realistically get playing time next season. And that's, you know, obviously you're not going to want to – like, you're probably not going to play 11 or 12 deep every game, but if you can get back to being that closer to that 9 or 10 that they were missing last season, it goes a long, long way. Especially when you think, you know, last year – you only have one true center available for pretty much all year, and he had his issues. Now you're going with three dudes who have experience playing that position.
He sits out the NIT, right? Like the one.
And he sits out the NIT, so you have to play, you know, a couple six. Yeah. You have to play a couple 6'8" guys. Yeah. You know, at that position. So just kind of that depth, and you can kind of see where the mixing and matching goes. How like the versatility of a guy like George Kimball could go a long way. Even a guy like Caleb Williams, because of his size, I think can give you some help in multiple positions. So check that out at The Observer. And then, you know, like I said, podcast, all that good stuff throughout the week.
I don't know your read on this, Justin. My sense would be if Auburn gets more than folks expect out of either Kimball or Freeman, the coaching staff deserves a ton of credit for being able to find a guy, being able to bet on a guy who – like, it's not based on last year.
They didn't have a lot of film on last year because they were hurt.
But here's the thing. I think they expect a decent bit out of Kimball. Like I think, I mean, he's your he's your only other point guard, and he's a guy that I think has that combo versatility where it's like, you know, he's going to be the – I think he's going to be the third most played guard by a decent bit. You know, true guard, you know, we can talk about with small forwards and all that.
And but. With options on the bench at guard, they're probably less likely to slide Kevin over and have him run point
guard. Yeah, when I talked to Stephen Pearl last week, he said they want to try to get Tahad off the ball a little bit more this season just to help a shot out, and saying that's where Kimball's going to come in. That's where being able to do some stuff with Kevin Overton, you know, some more of that stuff with Kevin Overton. So it's like it might be a situation where – you know, Tahad Pettiford and Kevin Overton are both on the floor at the same time, but it isn't necessarily always going to be, well, Tahad Pettiford is going to be the point guard. He's going to be the trigger man every single time. And then obviously they still have Blake Mychalek who, you know, will get – if he has that role this upcoming season, which it sounds like he could, where you feel like he can be the guy that can give you an extra breather, you feel a little bit better about that. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see because I think – as much as Tahad Pettiford grew as a true point guard this season for Auburn, you know, I think some of his shot making and his offense suffered a little bit because of all that, you know, kind of that load he had to carry. So they want to kind of, if they feel a little bit more flexible, like there could be plenty of times where you could see Kimball and Pettiford on the floor together and it not necessarily be Pettiford being the point guard. And that'd be pretty fun because Kimball was a guy a little bit bigger than Tahad. Was a true like lead guard when he was at East Kentucky.
Yeah, the thought of Tahad and Overton playing together and Overton running some point just because they want to get Tahad off
certain
the ball.
Certain sets. That's, you know, they've done that. And I go back to, what Auburn did a couple years ago with Denver Jones. Mm-hmm. There were some times they bring the ball up the floor, and here's Chad Becker-Mazzara doing it. And I'll tell you, Montas has some of that to his game as well, being able to at least be, you know, kind of a – he can be a trigger man, can, you know, pretty good with the ball in his hands.
I know NBA was projecting him as a point two or three years ago when he was going through
workouts. Yeah, I mean, he's got that European kind of tall point guard kind of build to him. And but, yeah, been a really, really good off-ball guy.
And if they're looking to carve out minutes for players in the front court – the thought of – I actually had someone ask me recently that, you know, I'm glad you reminded me of this, Bill, because, like, they wanted Justin's thoughts on, like, how often Montas could actually play at guard, at the one or the two, or if he's pretty solidly a three. Because,
he could play the two. Yeah. He could play the two when Stephen Pearl was talking about the opening left on the roster a few weeks ago. He said they wanted a guy with 3-2 versatility, right. And I think you could easily do a lineup of – you can slide Montas over to the two and then play a Adam Olsen at the three or even a Thomas Dowd at the three if you want to go like Freeman at the four and go ultra big. So, yeah, if you want to go big bully ball kind of lineup, you could definitely play him there. And, yeah, in Auburn's offense, the two and the three are pretty interchangeable. They defensively, it's where you start to like – your threes usually are going to face guys that are bigger and a little bit more of the slasher wing stuff, and that's where you have to get, you know, it for Auburn. Always to me, I felt like the two and the three are pretty interchangeable with what they do. It's just responsibilities on defense is where you see the most difference.
They weren't in position for the reasons you outlined earlier. They weren't in position to mix and match, to like try to match up other teams last year, because they could play a little bit with Hall. I think they, you could slide him around a little bit.
There were times where they would want to play Sway at the three. In fact, if they would have brought Sway back, they were planning on using him at the three a decent bit more. Hall obviously played some three, you know, as well. But yeah, I mean, it's just when you have an underman front court, it's hard to go big when you only really had two, say Sway's at the three. It's like, well, there's literally only two other bigs you can put out there at the four and the five.
And I'd have loved for Sway to come back. I'd have loved Freeman to come back. I think Auburn's approach in replacing them and going with a lot of college basketball experience, but also emphasizing shooting, right? Like, I feel like between, and you could question it with Thomas Dowd, but I'm telling you, like, he can score around the rim, and his jump shot has gotten better every year at Troy.
Oh yeah,
and then with players like Olsen and Montas, like and Kimball, like, it seems like Auburn is able to go with more shooting.
Oh yeah,
this and that was you know, at times
they're older, they're deeper, and they've got more shooting and bigger. Like, I think all four of those things, they have taken a step forward. And it's just a matter of putting it all together.
If you were a defense last year trying to match up with Auburn, a possession that ended with an Elijah Freeman three-point attempt or even a Sebastian three-point attempt, all things considered,
that was a win. Usually,
if you were a defense and you could, and so that to me, especially when you consider those guys as rebounders,
right?
It's like, and if they're shooting a three, they're probably not impacting the offensive rebound. And it's like, you know, that's something that's going to be tougher to concede based on what we know about this team.
Yeah, you're not going to want Montas. You're not going to want Montas and Olsen to like, you're not going to live with those guys shooting threes. That's what they do.
Even
Dowd
really from
well.
The corner, right? Like, I'd be a little more nervous.
Dowd, I just would say, like, he could be end up being one of your best rebounders. So, like, you're going to want that, and he's okay stretching the floor. That's just, you know, he was a double double machine last year at Troy.
Yep. All right, let's get to our final break of hour number one. Keep an eye on the SEC tournament. Florida has added a run. They lead 3-0 over Alabama as they play in the top of the fifth. Final game of the day. Looks like the rain has backed away for a little while there in Hoover. We'll be back. Come on in and join us here on the Thursday Drive.
This is Coach Stephen Pearl, and you're listening to The Drive with Bill.
Call 334-321-1390. Toll free at 888-382-7502 or email thedrive@espnau.com.
Welcome back into the Thursday Drive. Final few minutes here of hour number one. Florida adds another run while we were gone, and I believe they're now going to the bottom of the fifth. No, it's still top five. Alabama making a pitching change, and Florida had 4-0. Remember, this is a single elimination tournament, and I don't know. I mean, I guess the teams that have been eliminated aren't crazy about it, but I think everyone is much more pleased that this is not a double elimination tournament anymore. Yeah, imagine a 16-team double elimination tournament.
It was unwieldy.
You need 2 weeks.
It was unwieldy at 12, yes. Right? Like, let alone when A&M joined the league, the thing got confused. So. Auburn Sports Network coverage tomorrow of Auburn and A&M.
Yes. Now, right now,
question mark.
I mean, you know, because yesterday these games here were supposed to have been played this afternoon or tonight. So right now, I haven't seen any indication that tomorrow's games are being moved up, but they could be. So the schedule is for Auburn to play at 7:00 tomorrow. Should be the first game at 3:00, and then the second game will be at 7:00. So Auburn and Texas A&M will play tomorrow night tentatively at 7:00, but it could move up and be like this Alabama-Florida game if they're concerned about weather tomorrow night.
Real quick, before we wrap things up in hour number one, Jess, I know you told folks about some of your recent projects with the Observer. Wanted to shout out Henry's been doing great work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
covering baseball.
We'll have a story out in the morning about Auburn in their SEC baseball tournament game against A&M, and maybe the rest of the run in Hoover if they do such.
Would you like to throw our buddy Justin Lee a plug in the closing minute or so of this first hour?
Yeah, Auburn Torch. Go check it out. He was on top of everything with Auburn tennis, women's mm-hmm. tennis coming down to the very end with a shot at the national title. He's been on top of, let's see, Auburn track. He's got some Auburn track stuff in the works with the Tigers looking to add some more championships at nationals over these next couple of weeks. Gymnastics news.
Is he doing men's golf coverage?
He's doing men's golf as well, keeping an eye on all that.
California.
So
are the women. Yep.
Whoo, that was a nervy regional there.
Yeah, came down to the final nine.
Yeah.
But they were so dominant on the back nine.
Yep. And so they're going to look to, you know, hopefully play their best golf again back out west in California. So go to the Auburn Torch. Subscribe there. If you subscribe to the Observer and the Torch, you can do so both for less than $10 a month. So you get everything: Auburn football, men's basketball, some baseball, and then all the Olympic sports at Auburn are all covered in your email inbox. You go to auburntorch.com.
By the way, shocking news in the last 20 minutes. Kyle Busch passed away at the age of 41.
Wow.
This is announced by NASCAR. I know there was news of an illness earlier today. NASCAR announcing, saddened and heartbroken to share the news, the passing of Kyle Busch, two-time Cup champion, one of the sport's greatest and fiercest drivers, 41 years old. Deepest condolences to the Busch family, Richard Childress Racing, and the entire motorsports community.
Yeah, shocking
news. So just all the best to the echo that all the best to the Busch family as we come back for hour number two.
Yeah, we will be back. Got another hour to go. Come on in and join us. 334-321-1390. That's the Drive Hotline, sponsored by Skybar, and we'd love to hear from you.
The following is an Auburn Network production. Live from Auburn, the sports capital of Alabama, this is The Drive. The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck on ESPN 106.7. And online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of The Drive, call 334-321-1390. Toll free at 888-382-7502. Or email The Drive at ESPNAU.com.
Welcome in to hour number two of the Thursday Drive. Bill, Dan, Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer here in the studio on this nice-looking hot Thursday afternoon. Rained a little bit in Hoover, and the rain has stopped, but the Florida scoring parade has not. It was the top of the fifth a while ago when we went to our final break before the top of the hour. It is still the top of the fifth inning, and Florida now leads Alabama. Is it 6 or 7? It may be 7. Yes, it is. The extra point's good. And Florida is leading Alabama 7-0 in the top of the fifth. This is the second game of the day. Alabama's first game, they were one of the four teams with double byes. Georgia, your regular season champ. Oh, that was an error by Justin LeBron, your top 10 draft pick, who made a fabulous play a little while ago, but he can be a little inconsistent. Not as inconsistent as the Alabama right fielder that we've watched.
I don't know what his deal is.
Justin asked a question that my
I put it on Twitter and no one's been able to answer me either.
My wife has asked this many times of me. Why do so many baseball players wear sunglasses on the brim of their cap
without wearing them in the field?
And when the sun is shining, where they're in the field with sunglasses on the top of their hat, not covering their eyes.
I think
it's just because they think it looks cool.
These aren't popular anymore, but when I was playing growing up, they had the flips.
Mm-hmm.
And that one at least made a little bit of sense, because it's like, okay, like you need to flip them down if there's a glare, if the sun's changing or something like that. But, like, to leave them on your hat the whole time, like, and these are, that's the other thing, too. is that a lot of times these glasses that these dudes are wearing, like pro ball, college ball.
Centerfielder's got the same thing, that got the exact same look.
Pro ball, college ball, like they're expensive sunglasses.
Yes.
It's like it's not one that like you necessarily want to have like fall off.
Yeah. These are probably, I'd say, especially like the SEC level, like these are probably coming from the apparel provider. And it's probably
or you're paying out of pocket.
Yeah. And to me, maybe it's, I mean, Bill, you know how superstitious baseball players can be. Like maybe they just get used to not wearing them because so many of these games are at night. And so it's like, well, when you have the occasional day game, like it's
then why not
leave
wear
the glasses?
Again,
in your bag,
I'm not going to be able to offer anything but flimsy, yeah, flimsy reasoning here.
Whatever. I mean, that's not the only reason they're losing. Florida's hit a couple of bombs, but it is a 7-0 game. I wanted to get into, and we will hear in a little bit, but we'd love to hear from you. 334-321-1390. Want to get into the news from LSU with Justin here before too long, but let's get to the phones first.
Yeah, our buddy Brian is calling. And what's up, bud?
Hey, guys. No, I was just going to answer your question. You answered the question, Bill. It's for looks. It's the same reason why a football player would wear 3 Apple Watches on his arm.
the other one that drives me even crazier than the watch thing in football was the double mouthpiece. I never understood that. The guys that have the 2 mouthpiece, I don't get it. Like, and you don't wear either of them.
There are some teams with wearables. I don't know necessarily if the Apple Watch is it, but you know, like they're tracking, you know, and there's.
Let me tell you, it'd be much better to do the stuff that's like connected to like shoulder pads.
I think a lot of that's probably like especially at the college level. Yeah, it's on the player.
No, I put this on Twitter, and no one has been able to give me anything other than it looks. You know, they think it looks cool, so I'm with you there.
Yeah, if you're out there, you got to look cool while you're doing it, right?
I think you're getting absolutely smoked in right field. That's
not the way people are not going to remember the Alabama right fielder for his sunglasses.
And I guess, Brian, I'm showing my age here. I always thought that wearing sunglasses was cool, right? Like I was associate, like, you know, the coolest people were that, like, whether it was, you know, like Dion with the wraparounds in the field or the Terminator, right? Like some of the coolest people.
Oh, yeah, they look cool. Yeah. But, like, I don't understand why putting
Joe
them on
Campbell?
Your hat.
I mean, some of the coolest people out there wore sunglasses.
At times, though, at times, those sunglasses are tough. It is tough to really follow the ball if you're wearing sunglasses.
Clarence Carter?
Time. Yeah.
Well, shoot, I've got a 15-year-old. I don't know how he goes out and drives and does all this stuff without his sunglasses, but I can't even go out in the sun without my sunglasses.
I can't.
Anyways, that's all I got. Be good, guys.
Appreciate it, Brian.
To Brian's point, I can't check my mail without sunglasses. If the sun's out, I'm used.
I don't know. I forget sometimes, and I mean, I'm out in the sun.
I started wearing sunglasses like really early, like to the point where I think my eyeballs are just way too sensitive to at this point. Yeah. Where it's like if I go outside without sunglasses, and it can be like if I'm like it's not super cloudy outside, but it's like
a little bit of a glare.
If I walked out there right now, I'd have to have them on.
And I wonder how much of that was out of necessity and utility, and how much of that again was influenced by seeing so many people we associated with coolness wearing those sunglasses.
For me, it's my eyes.
Yeah. For me, it was seeing how cool Snoopy looked when he put the sunglasses on.
Well, like my brother doesn't wear sunglasses hardly at all, and I'm like, and it'll be as bright, shiny of a day as it is, and I'm like, how are you not blind?
I don't think about it sometimes. And another reason was the best sunglasses I had always got broken.
Oh yeah. Oh,
so it's like, you know, and the cheap ones didn't do the job.
This is the most expensive pair of sunglasses I've ever owned, and they're $30.
Sunglasses and earpods, right, are two things that I feel like if I splurge on them, it will be just start the clock, and they will be destroyed or missing.
I go through cheap sunglasses pretty quickly, so I have a brand I really, really like, but then you know, I know that every couple of years I'm going to be buying a new pair.
They never lasted a couple of years for me.
So. That's something, and I mean it's not really splurging, but like when I would travel with Troy and go to some of these towns that I'd never been to before, and I wanted to go downtown or something. If I popped into a thrift store or a secondhand or something, I'd go look at the sunglass section and see if there's anything cool and old. And I got a couple like older pairs of sunglasses that have been. And that's the best of both worlds, right? Because I feel like they were built well and they've been maintained, but they're also they didn't set me back an arm and a leg or anything like that. So, but no, I, I'm I echo you guys. Like, put the sunglasses on if you're out there in the outfield and it's a day game.
Well, I mean, if you've got them on your head, why not use them? You know, especially if you're acting like you can't find the ball. 334-321-1390. All right, Justin, I wanted to get your thoughts.
Yeah.
On the Will Wade, mm-hmm. Situation there, signing R.J. Lewis.
Will Wade is currently conducting what I believe to be the basketball recruiting version of the Legion of Boom theory, which is you can't penalize us every time. So I think he's of the opinion there. It's like, what are they going to do? Not let me field a basketball team this year? Like, I think that's the gambit he's playing here, where it's like, you know, We can get tied down in legal stuff and get bogged down in the details, and I'm going to get these guys out there. Or LSU's not going to have a team. They're not going to have enough. They'll either have to play a bunch of walk-ons or –
Well, he's added a bunch of foreign guys.
Maybe, yeah. R.J. Lewis is a decoy, and the NCAA will feel so good about rendering him ineligible that they'll let the other players slide.
Yeah, yeah. That's the strategy. Legion Moon thing.
It's like, yeah, he's thinking, all right, well, you know, if you give him R.J. Lewis, who – and you know what? I don't know your thoughts on this, Justin. My suspicion would be leaving college basketball to go through the draft process. That alone, I'm not sure that should make you ineligible. Like, maybe if we change the rule, if you say, like, all right, well, a guy can go through the draft.
Yeah, right now, like, it does.
If a guy goes undrafted, he has the option to return to college basketball after the draft is over if he wants.
Like, yeah, you can do that.
Or even if he doesn't like where he was drafted and he wants to use that as leverage with his NBA team.
I'm not quite as sold
like,
on that.
Like baseball players can do.
Yeah,
like,
but again, they're
There's not
a lot
two
of
rounds.
Those baseball players are high schoolers.
There's not two rounds, just two rounds,
in the NBA.
But the thought of a guy leaving college basketball, going through the draft process, going undrafted, signing with a G League team, and then saying, you know what, I've changed my mind, I actually want to come back to college
basketball.
He was
part of a trade.
Yes. Right. Yeah. One of the recruiting websites has like the graphic of the teams he's played for. And it's like the Boston Celtics are one of the listed teams next to St. John's. And so, I mean, the parts of the R.J. Lewis case to me are interesting. But once you've signed with a G League team, it does seem reminiscent of Bediako, who was ultimately ruled ineligible because the NCAA's position has and still is.
Oh, they came out just a few days before R.J. Lewis signed with LSU and reiterated, no, you're not going to be eligible if you have signed a pro contract.
So let's see if they hold up to it, you know.
Well, I mean, they're going to stick to their guns, but we'll see what a Louisiana judge says.
The kid they got the other day, the Israeli guard that was drafted in the 20 class, like, it's insane. Insane. Like,
Montas was talked about as 20 and 21. I think there were years where, like, there were.
He went through two different drafts, and I think it was 21 and 24 or 22 and 24.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, Montas has been circling college basketball for a while as well. But you're right; it does seem like Will Wade's mission now is to really stress test what the NCAA is going to allow and what they're not going to allow.
Montas was only really on college basketball's radar this past year because of the floodgates were open with the international players. I mean, personally speaking, I don't love the fact that, you know, a lot of these dudes can go, like, leave college basketball and then come back. Like, I have a really hard time doing that. And I, you know, in all honesty, I have a hard time with guys like Montas and guys like Philip Jovich. I'm just being honest. Like, I don't know if college basketball needs these kinds of players. Like, I don't know if that's the direction they need to go. However, it is the rule, and you can do it, so I can see why teams are doing it. This one, though, is just – It's beyond the pale.
I think one of the problems is it's just difficult for the NCAA to say, well, this league is okay,
right?
This international league's okay, this one is not, or you know, things like that. That's what's so difficult.
The tough thing is that it has been the system where when you declare for the NBA draft, you forego your eligibility. Yep. So in that case, R.J. Lewis and Charles Bediako and guys like that would be ineligible. Montas would also be ineligible in that if you go by the letter of the law there, but again, I say letter of the law knowing that the law is very vague there.
He wasn't an NCAA player when
right.
he did.
Yeah, it's like, can you forfeit your eligibility? Can you forfeit your eligibility if you never had it to begin
right.
with?
So there's a really famous story from 30 years ago where Charles Barkley saw a teenage Dirk Nowitzki while playing internationally overseas and got the idea, like, what would it cost to send this guy to Auburn and go play at Auburn? And of
more
course,
than he had.
Right. And I think one of the things that would have complicated the issue is that Germany was one of the countries, and Europe had several of these, where you would draft players into the professional ranks, so they'd go into the.
He was already playing professional.
Yeah, it's like the soccer systems, right? Where like you'll identify a future pro at 13 or 14, and start getting him ready for.
Yeah,
and
he was on their youth teams,
and technically, guys on those youth teams had turned pro by signing with.
There's no difference in that and Jovic. There's no difference in that and
Mott. Like, the NCAA sort of changed their stance.
In 1990-whatever, when he saw Dirk, it would have been illegal. In 2025, you could 100% be doing it.
Because – and I think it – I mean, the thought that, like, all right, well, the decision this kid made at 13 in his European village, like, that renders him ineligible from college basketball.
Let's get something completely specific and very, very, you know, telling for the moment right now. Like, this week in basketball, if – he would have been, if he'd have been at maybe a year younger, Victor Wembanyama could have played college basketball. Yep. Somebody could have seen, hey, there's a 17-year-old, 18-year-old kid in France who's 7'5 and can do everything. And guess what? We're going to get him for the year before he can become an NBA player. And Kentucky or North Carolina or Duke or whoever would have been able to pay whatever it took to come in there. But the fact is that he was a little early. He was not in that window when this rule was pushed and stress tested. But yeah, I mean, like, there is a real reality where, like, you could see, okay, Victor Wembanyama could have played a year of college basketball. Yeah, like, and that's insane to think about, because I don't know what anybody would have done with that.
Like, remember when Kevin Durant was a freshman at Texas? Imagine if that guy was 7'5". Like, that's what you're doing with Victor Wembanyama.
You know how crazy Anthony Davis was? All right, this dude's half a foot taller than him.
Remember when Anthony Davis? Remember when Anthony Davis was a freshman? He was the best player in college basketball, like, by far. Like, yeah, it's that.
Yeah. When Anthony Davis was a freshman at Kentucky, he was the best college basketball player I had ever seen with my own two eyes. And this dude's even better.
Let's make him Yao Ming sized and see if that changes things.
But it could have happened. It 100% could have happened. It's so crazy to think about. I mean, heck, a little bit different, but like, I mean, it would have been tough. It would have been really, really tough because of the money. You would have had to have really made the money competitive. But like, Luka Doncic could have played college basketball. Now, you would have had to outpay Real Madrid to get him, which is pretty tough. But like, yeah, like, there's. It's crazy to think college basketball is like, you know what, we have this thing now in college basketball where you have the NBA and then you have EuroLeague as kind of the second year. And then you have college basketball as this kind of like floating middle tier where it's like, well, sometimes it's better for these guys to make that jump sometimes you'd be better off playing overseas. And it's really, really weird to think about.
I mean, I remember what the fuss made about DeBonsa getting – $6 million reportedly from BYU.
It's nothing.
Does BYU, like, do they feel like they got their money's worth?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he
100%
20 plus wins.
Dude,
the guy's
trying to force a deal to the Jazz right now. Yeah. Because that's the thing there.
By the way, imagine that sentence. NBA player trying to force his way to Salt Lake City. Yeah.
But if you are a guy who made a lot of money and became a legend overnight in that market, why wouldn't you want to stay there?
It would be like if it'd be like, I'm trying to think of like a guy who meant a lot to, like, Hansborough. Like, it was a weird example, but like if somebody who was like, if he was lottery pick good and the local franchise thought, not only could this guy impact us from a basketball standpoint, but it means business too. Mm-hmm.
If the Charlotte Hornets could have guaranteed they got Zion.
Sure. Zion's a better example. Like that. Yeah. Like,
because he was a South Carolina kid. Yeah, he was a Carolina kid.
Yeah. Like, it's that sort of thing where, I mean, you wonder what, I mean, the Wizards are already in an excellent position with the first overall pick in this draft. And presumably a healthy Anthony Davis and Trae Young next year alongside whoever they take.
They're gonna be absolute monsters in the 2018 playoffs. They're gonna try to get next year.
That's right. And then you could
can't why you gotta watch
bubble,
out for that
in the bubble playoff. Yeah. They're gonna be outstanding in 2020. But then
this was NBA 2K19. They'd be all over it.
The thought that you could add whatever the Jazz are willing to give up to go from one to two. Like if that's what you want to do, to like if.
I wonder how much it would cost for them to make that trade.
Because that's what I'd be doing with Washington. It's not so much like, oh, we're going to pass on Devonta so that he's still on the board at two. It's like, yeah, if you really want him that bad and if he's that important to your franchise, like make a deal.
Yeah, make an offer.
Add Walker Kessler to the mix or something. You know what I mean? Find something that works for you.
It would take, yeah. It'd be very interesting to think how much it would cost to go up one spot in a draft. But to guarantee that you got your guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've seen how crazy NBA trades get.
I bet Ace Bailey'd be okay with a trade to Washington. Was he the one who was furious about being dead? Who was the guy who was unhappy about
it? It was Ace.
Yeah, it was Ace Bailey, right? Who got
but
traded.
He did go to Washington.
Oh, who was the one who didn't want to go to Utah? And it was like there
he
was
didn't
like,
want to go to Utah.
And he ended up in Washington.
Washington. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, he would take it.
Well, he is in Washington.
Yeah, he'd be okay with the trade.
19 minutes after 5 o'clock.
No, he would get traded to Utah.
Yeah. Here on the Thursday drive, we'll get to our first break. Again, phone lines are open, 334-321-1390. Come on in here on the Thursday drive.
The Drive with and online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of The Drive, call 334-321-1390. Toll free at 888-382-7502 or email thedrive@ESPNAU.com.
Welcome back into The Drive, 23 minutes after 5 o'clock here on this Thursday. Let's see, we talked quite a few things. One thing we didn't mention is that we know who Auburn's opening up the Players Era tournament
again. Yeah.
Yeah, revenge for the Eric Stevenson game on the menu for Auburn. They'll be playing West Virginia to open that. They're on a side of a bracket that the other side is. They would play the winner or loser, depending. UNLV in Kansas is the other side of that one. And then, obviously,
whoever's on the other side.
Whoever comes out the other. I am looking forward to that, though, because the bracket will be, like, it is kind of lame that they're doing an 8 one week and then a 16 the other week, but, mm-hmm. like, it's better than the
You like it, the fact also that it's not Thanksgiving week.
Oh, that's ideal. Like, if I end up going this year, which I hope I'll be able to, that's even better, and it's like, you know, it's Auburn's FCS game this year, I believe, mm-hmm. is that weekend, so... Well, try to make. I really enjoyed the event last year. I just really thought it was dumb how they formatted it, and you kind of really didn't know what was going on. It was just kind of go out there and play three basketball games.
Kind of encouraged people to leave before that third game too, right? It's almost. I mean, only the sickos were there for Auburn St. John's. Like it's the day before Thanksgiving,
and if you're out there this year, I believe that's one of the weekends the Eagles have added for the Spear.
Ooh, so if Bill Cameron's out there potentially,
that weekend is the Formula One race.
Wow. Out there. Oh, the Formula One race there was because that impacted. I mean, that impacted getting around some in Thanksgiving week. Like you could tell they were tearing down.
They were tearing down stuff from the
They were tearing down stuff. You know, up and down the strip. Ross Hodge is the head coach at West Virginia. He was at North Texas for a couple of years. Had a really good had a 27 win team at North Texas to get the West Virginia job. They were a 20 win team mm-hmm. this past year and should be. I mean, it's hard to tell who's a player and who isn't in the Big 12, but you know, feels like West Virginia would be would be optimistic that they can build on a 20-win season in year one for Ross Hodge. But good non-conference opponent for Auburn.
Yeah, very much. I mean, not knowing who all's on that roster, like, strikes me a lot like their opener in the last year, where it's like, okay, this is a team that might not be a contender in their conference right now, but that is a power conference team who has been good in years past.
Who has Kansas in the other? Because it's
UNLV.
It's UNLV in Kansas on the other side, so Auburn could potentially play the Jayhawks mm-hmm. in the second game if they beat West Virginia.
Yeah, and then you know that they're playing Wisconsin in Nashville. You know Arizona's got a road return trip. They're supposed to be playing Middle Tennessee and Huntsville at some point. You would think they're going on the road for the ACC-SEC Challenge this year. And then if they kind of follow the same format as last season, the last couple seasons, that Atlanta game the second week of December could still be open. If they want to go back.
I wanted to mention.
Which I keep thinking they're not going to go back, and they go back every year.
Oh, yeah?
Year, so.
I mean.
It's your they work. They keep that event afloat.
Yeah.
100%.
And I'm glad
it's getting tougher
to find somebody.
To find people who are willing to play them.
I'm glad that they're keeping, because there was talk of moving Players Era later in the season or even doing, like, not trying to compete with college football and the NFL with the Players Era by playing it
Play in the middle of the week.
Play in the middle of but the idea of playing it in the middle of conference season or something
to try to push it, play a tournament in the middle of conference. No, I think
part of the reason it makes sense is because you're still figuring out who you are in November and December, and games like the ones you play in Players Era help you determine your identity. I think they're useful.
Three games in 3 days, and it's not the end of the world if you lose one. Like, that's a good format. You learn a lot about yourself in those stretches. And I think Auburn, even though the season did not end up being the type of season they wanted to at the end, I think they learned a lot about who they were by getting the highs and the low and then the high again of playing in Players Era last year.
When do they go to Greece?
August.
Okay.
Beginning of August.
Wanted to mention before we got a couple minutes
and
left.
They will start – they'll start – first week of June will be on the floor when they get back on the floor. They started coming in this weekend. They're going to start trickling in a little bit more after the holiday weekend. They're going to really ramp up, making sure everybody gets on campus that can get here and go through medical testing and all that.
Talked about it a little bit in the first hour. Ferg had some interesting thoughts about how recruiting is going for Alex Golish so far.
Pretty good.
First of all, you pointed out, like, going and getting an offensive tackle like Leighton, I mean, it's impressive in its own right, no matter where he's from. But to go up there and
take a dude from Notre Dame.
Penn State was circling too.
My thing there is just Notre Dame. With their pedigree on the offensive line, like, that's a big win. That's a huge win. And, again, like, it's going to take years of work for Auburn's offensive line to get back, I think, to a position where they want to be. However, knowing that this is a position group where you need to recruit and develop and it takes more time, you don't have time to waste. And for a guy like Tyler Danik, who came in with – I think Auburn fans, when he was hired as the offensive line coach, knowing how much attention the offensive line's gotten the last decade, really, for Auburn – it was kind of, you saw some people kind of like, yeah, he was the USF offensive line coach, but, I mean, like, this dude was still playing college football. Like, he played
just
Auburn
a few years ago, right?
Yeah, he played Auburn in the 17 Peach Bowl at UCF, and it's like, I don't know, I don't know what it's going to be, because he's not a very experienced guy compared to maybe his peers in the SEC offensive line coach. So to be able to do what they did in the transfer portal and have an offensive line where I think I wrote about it today, The Observer, in the mailbag, I think this offensive line being as new as it is going to naturally create some issues. You're going to have some growing pains and some problems, and you're going to have to work through it. But the one thing about this offensive line that I really like is that it's not all rentals. You got some, but you've got depth, and you've got pieces, and you've got dudes
brought in
you can
some
develop.
Transfers that have multiple years of eligibility.
Correct.
I really got to like that.
And so you pair that approach with, okay, now get some of these young guys in that you can kind of develop for the future. And guys who have been really good prospects. We were talking about it the other day. If you look at Auburn's all-time offensive line commitments on the composite, Leighton is directly between Lee Ziemba and Braden Smith. Like, it's that type of prospect. Now, yes, Calvin Ashley and Christian Westerman are up at the top of that list, but, pretty good neighborhood, like, when it comes to the guys directly around him. Like, when you say, hey, Auburn got a top 75 player and a top 5 player, or a top 75 overall prospect and a top 5 offensive lineman in his class, Ziemba and Smith, that's, like, the type of guys you're looking at.
I mean, think about, like, high school tackles Auburn has signed who saw significant playing time of late. I mean, you got to go back to, like, Troxel. You got to go back to, like, Sean Coleman. It's been a while. I mean, it's maybe – one of the reasons you've seen uneven results.
Tega eventually.
Yeah.
He was like defensive end for like what, 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Good point. That experiment ended pretty quickly, but yeah.
And just the thought, Bill, that like Auburn has someone who, while he's an outsider and while most of these coaches are outsiders to Auburn, Cody Burns the notable exception on the offense, like they've still seemingly like embraced a lot of what's worked for Auburn coaches.
Oh, I talked about how I think it's cool, and obviously the last staff did this as well, so it's not. But I think it's cool for Auburn's new staff to come in and be like, "All right, Big Cat Weekend, is that what y'all do here? All right, let's do it." Like that's kind of thing. And I think Golish, from day one, from his intro press conference at Auburn through now, I think you've seen a guy who has been really excited to embrace Auburn and the traditions right. and what makes mm-hmm. Auburn Auburn for a guy who has not been here before. And I think that's really, really cool. Dan made a really good counter to where while the last coaching staff, the last head coach, did some of those things, there was a lot of the branding that was kind of being like very him-centric, very, you know, him for it. And it's just – this feels a little different.
Freeze warning.
And then the guy – and then the guy, oh, too. Yeah, yeah. And then the guy, too – well, I mean – the guy, too, coaching cycles ago was all about himself, right?
But I mean – junked all that tradition of the garbage. And, yeah. Who needs this?
But, I mean, the thing is –
who needs this? We have grit.
A lot of people didn't realize when he was named, he has so many of the traits that Auburn – that have been successful at all.
Oh, yeah.
I mean – his not just personality wise, but his style, his philosophy, his yeah. you know, I mean, we're gonna run the damn ball. I mean, they're gonna, you know, I mean, they're gonna do. He wants to do some things that Auburn people want Auburn to do.
And I think he also comes through it with, and you have to evolve and you have to modernize this approach over time. But he strikes me a lot with like with Gus Malzahn when he came in, where it's just like, here's this offense. It's innovative. It's different. And it's like, it's designed to work with an underdog. It is designed to, hey, we might not have the most talent on the field week in and week out, which is the reality of where you are at Auburn in the SEC, but we can get some really good talent, and if we do it this way, we can beat teams that may have more five stars than us, that may have more NFL guys than us. And, like, that's what Golish did at Tennessee. I mean, Tennessee instantly became – pretty successful yeah. doing that.
And they got more talent, and they and you know, a lot of their folks wish they were still doing some of the things they were doing
oh, yeah.
when Alex was there. But I mean, it's not like Tennessee is always, you know, or I don't know that Auburn wants to always feel like they're going to be playing with less talent.
No. But I'm saying, like, how many years in the modern era of college football have we said that Auburn team is more talented than Alabama and Georgia? Very few.
No, you're
very
right.
few.
Rarely.
And so, you know,
if at all.
And now there's LSU, you know, resurging again. There's Texas A&M. There's Texas. There's Oklahoma. There's mm-hmm. you'll play a Florida team that's they think they have their act together. Tennessee. So it's like, if you're Auburn, you can rarely, if ever, expect, oh, we're going to have a team that's going to be the most talented one on the field. I mean, I'll say this: most years, like, if you say just on paper talent, like, the best case scenario for Auburn is, like, you'll have a 12-game season, you may be the more talented team in 9 of them, right? Like,
right.
9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I think you have to do some of that. Like, there's some of that kind of stuff where you just have to just pin your ears back and just do the stuff that overcomes, you know, more talent.
I would say the last
– have to have some underdog to you.
The last 15 years that the SEC West existed – right, like, you had Alabama, LSU, and Georgia on the schedule every yeah. year, and it was like, okay, well, you're never on paper more talented than any.
Well, I mean,
maybe very rarely, you know, maybe not never. Well, I mean, I'd say the last time Auburn went into an Iron Bowl as the more talented team on paper, it might be the first Saban one. Right, like,
yeah.
like I mean, you might need to go back to like 07.
But it's like, you know, but it's that kind of mindset that ethos as well, where it's just like, we're going to do what we do, and we feel like if we do what we do well, we can beat teams that may have more talent. And like, Bill, you would know this better than me because you lived through it. Wasn't that Pat Dye's whole thing?
Yes,
like that was very much the like, I know Alabama, I know Georgia. I ain't scared of them. Here's what we got to do to mm-hmm. beat these teams. And I think you got to have that kind of mentality. And
well,
not just say you can beat them at your own game.
And he showed some of that. I mean, there was very reminiscent when he was asked that about struggles against Alabama when he pretty much said,
heck,
not me,
heck,
not us,
heck, were the,
yet.
Heck were the successful years under Terry Bowden. That was just like, whoa, we're doing something completely different. And it was working. Now, I'd say mm-hmm. Tupperville took advantage of the fact that Alabama wasn't Alabama at that point. But even still, like mm-hmm. – you had to do some things a little different.
Right. A refusal to be outworked, right? Like, even if maybe you're out talented, like, there's this, all right, well, some of the things we can control will
the approach
be.
Of the approach of, like, we're like, we'll have the dudes. And it's like, that's a lofty goal to have, but it's
yeah,
just
it's
like
great to think that.
Man, it's hard to do. It's
hard
to put it in action.
It's hard. Right.
And what do you do in the meantime? And I think that's what really killed the Hugh Freeze era is you didn't do much of anything in the meantime.
You were getting the dudes. You were getting more of the dudes, but it wasn't resulting in more of the wins.
Correct.
All right, let's get to our bottom of the hour break. A little bit behind, but that's okay. Still time for you to join us if you'd like. 334-321-1390 for the final 20 minutes of the Thursday Drive.
7502 or email the drive at espnau.com.
Welcome back in. Final 20 minutes here on the Thursday Drive. Bill, Dan, and Justin, and let's get back to the Drive hotline. I think Brian's back with us.
Yeah, another question. What's up, Brian?
Yeah, hey, guys. Sorry, I was going through a bad area before, so I thought I was going to lose you. But, no, one comment and then one question. One comment was going to be, you know, just about what you guys were talking about. I say, too, I mean, it's great to have the Jimmys and Joes, obviously, but I think development's been a big problem, too. I think Tucker
lack
Cole
of,
was the last
yes.
coach we had that I thought was a good developer of talent. And I'm hoping, and from what I see, I'm hoping that Golish is that way. He appears to be. So I'm excited about that because we haven't had a coach that could do that since Tupperville, in my opinion.
But
the question I was – sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, the question I was going to say is, what do we think about Yaya football coming back to LSU?
Yeah, well, that was going to be the next thing after the Will Wade is the fact that Ed O is back. You know what? I don't see it being a problem. I mean, he's
back,
a Cajun. Oh, he and Lane are very
USC.
Tight.
USC boys.
Yes, absolutely.
He was the interim when Lane got fired from USC. O right. was the interim there.
Probably should have gotten the job instead
probably
of
probably should have. And a heck of hey, there's nothing wrong with him as a D-line coach or a recruiter.
No, not at all. I have a friend of mine who went to LSU, and I saw him retweet somebody today who he said we're either winning multiple national championships or everyone's getting arrested or maybe
or
both.
Maybe
or both.
And I feel like that's a good.
It, you know, Georgia's had a couple of kids arrested over the last few years, and they won some games.
He knows the territory. He's beloved by a big chunk of that fan base and a big chunk of that state. Like I think it makes a ton of sense, especially if he's interested in a position like that.
Look,
at LSU, like I think it makes
Brian,
sense.
Brian, your point, like my thing is like once we saw Arkansas offensive coordinator Bobby Petrino again, like I was just like anybody can come back. Anything can happen at this point.
Well, I agree with you, Dan. I think I'm no fan of Kiffin, but I think it's a brilliant move.
Oh yeah. 100%.
For 2 points. One, like what you were saying, Dan, with recruiting and but he's beloved by that, and I think Kiffin's gonna, I think Kiffin eventually is gonna rub some people the wrong way down there, and I think he's a great buffer for that. I also heard rumors, and I don't know if this is true or not, that he was running a little low on cash, too. So I think that was another factor that played into it.
Would not surprise me.
No, it wouldn't. He was in style. The last time I saw him was down on 30A, and he was living it up pretty well.
Now he got a settlement in the neighborhood of $20 million from LSU when he lost that job a couple of years ago, or a buyout in that in that ballpark. So, I know times are tough around the country.
He had to give half of that up.
Well,
he had to give half of that up. I think in the divorce, though. I think he lost close to $7 to $10 million.
Well, when the tax man and the ex-wife get involved, maybe 20
maybe
million.
You need to get back to work.
It's whittled down.
Goes a little quick.
All right, thanks for the time again, guys.
Cool, Brian.
I mean, shout out to Paul McCartney, right, Bill? The tax man, maybe showing up there to send you
but
back.
No,
to
I
work.
Mean, I think it's a good move for Lane and for LSU.
100%. I mean, just obviously no hard feelings. It's and it feels like it's been a lifetime since he's been the head coach at this point.
Rumored performer on tonight's Colbert finale, by the way. That's the talk of potentially. Paul McCartney.
Oh, I was going
not Orgeron.
Ed Orgeron,
yeah,
Lane
no,
Kiffin.
Yeah, Ed Orgeron's going to say Ed Orgeron and Ringo are going to do a duet.
Be pretty entertaining.
Yeah. I'm sure. That'll be a heck of a show regardless.
Ed Orgeron and Dr. John.
That's right.
Get them going.
Jazz Fest 27.
Yeah. That would be pretty impressive. I think Dr. John. It's a little tough to expect a whole lot from him now.
Trombone
Shorty.
Shorty and John Baptiste are going to be there. Former Colbert bandmate.
That is right. That's exactly right. All right, you want to go ahead and get to the final break? We'll do that. That way we'll have a little time when we come back for the final segment here of the Thursday Drive.
The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck.
Coach Butch Thompson, and you're listening to The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck on Auburn Opelika Sports Leader. ESPN 106.7.
Welcome back in. Final segment here on the Thursday Drive. Bill, Dan, and Justin. And we got Crawford on the line.
Crawford is hanging on. What's up, buddy?
Long time since I called you.
Yeah, man, it has been.
Bill, I'm trying to join you. I am semi-retired now. I'm working 2 days a week.
Me too.
So maybe I'll have more time to get back in touch with y'all. So
I've got
a couple of questions and a comment.
True.
What has happened to Christian Chatterton?
That's a really good question. I mean, a guy who led the team in innings pitched last year and starts and struggled some early. Just really, you know, Auburn's pitching has been so good, they haven't needed to go deep into the bullpen. And he's a guy that just never has really profiled as a guy to come in mid-innings. So that's a really good question. Man, I'd nearly forgotten about it.
Remember, wasn't Chatterton the guy that when they moved Alvarez
gave him the first start.
They gave Christian a couple of opportunities. They may have drawn Georgia Tech for one of those, which is tough
Dan,
sledding.
You're exactly right. He got drilled at Georgia Tech, but I don't think he's pitched since then.
Yeah,
I don't think he has.
Yeah, I mean, with the season, you know, with things tightening up the last couple of weeks of the season, and Auburn maybe, you know, I think Griffin Graves got some of those midweek opportunities after that.
Isn't Christian just a sophomore, too?
I believe that's right. A true freshman last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was projected as a possible starter.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't understand that. And my comment is, how in the hell can Alabama be ahead of us on the seeding line when they're getting the hell beat out of my Florida? I'm sorry.
Well,
that is total BS.
Well, the fact that they finished a game ahead of Auburn and swept them in the head-to-head probably has a little to do with that.
And we'll see.
You're right. Florida is romping. Today it's 11-1 now,
and we will see. And of course, Alabama would point out. You know, Alabama people, I think, would tell you what happened in the series between Alabama and Auburn.
Right.
But like, we'll see. We'll see who's ahead in Monday's draw. That's you know, it's still TBD. I think.
Yeah. There's not a whole lot of difference in where Auburn, Alabama, and Texas A&M are. I mean, right now they're projected 6, good. 7, and 8 in some order.
Good stuff, Crawford.
Yep. Great hearing from you, Crawford. And that was a good question. I mean, I hadn't thought about Christian in a while. But I do think part of it is because the pitching staff has been so good that you haven't needed to try to go back to a couple of other guys. You've found some pieces beyond your big four that you use all the time with Marciano and Sanders, who we saw last night, and then Dre Alvarez and Alex Petrovic, and then your guys in the pen. I mean, with L.J. Cormier stepping up and the way Kulik has pitched, you already have, you know, Hetzler there at the end of the game. I mean, you've got some guys, and there hasn't been that much opportunity to go back to Christian.
No, so we'll – and especially this time of year, like, it feels like it's tougher to experiment with your pitching staffs because these games have outsized importance.
SEC tournament used to be a time when you did that when it was double elimination. Mm-hmm. You know, you might throw somebody out there for a little bit and see. But, not nearly as likely now as – you've seen in the past.
And there are some guys that have earned Butch's trust in high-leverage situations coming out of the bullpen, and it's just tougher to bypass one of those guys. Even though a lot of what I think folks liked about Christian as a true freshman still true, right? The off-speed stuff is really potent. It's just, I think locating and getting outs was...
And that's Butch's thing this year. I mean, it's been fill the strike zone, throw strikes, and, you know, he wasn't able to do that consistently. So Florida is 3 outs away from run-ruling Alabama here in the SEC tournament. They're looking to add more as they bat in the top of the 7th. 11-1, the Gators looking... Like I said, they're a team to look out for. Wherever they are... I mean, I don't think they're going to be a top 8 national seed, but they should be able to host the first round.
And Texas is up next, right? In the
no, this is the last game of the day.
Okay, Texas is tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was going to say because they
just got 2 games today and then 2 games tomorrow.
Yeah, they're not going to be able. I was going to say they'll wrap this up with a run rule, but it'll
be an early day. I mean, considering there was supposed to have been a 7. This game was supposed to have started at 7:00, so. Auburn right now is still scheduled for 7:00 tomorrow against Texas A&M. We'll see if they decide to move things up.
Want to mention it again. News broke during hour number one. I mean, again, not a ton of analysis to provide here, just terrible news. Kyle Busch, 41-year-old NASCAR champion, one of the greatest and fiercest drivers on the NASCAR circuit, passing away earlier today. News this morning that he was withdrawing this weekend from the race in Charlotte because of an illness and had been hospitalized. And less than 8 hours later,
he's gone.
News of his passing at the age of 41. Just terribly sad. Son celebrated an 11th birthday earlier this week. Mm. So all the best to his friends, his family, his fans. And everybody impacted by just awful news in the world of NASCAR today.
Yeah. You mentioned Texas. Texas and Arkansas will play the first game tomorrow. That game right now is scheduled for 3 o'clock. They could move it up the way they did the earlier game today when Georgia knocked off Mississippi State 5-3. But right now, it looks like 3 o'clock first game between Texas, Arkansas, and then Auburn and Texas A&M should play around 7. Let's see. Justin, before we run out of time.
One more time.
Yeah, remind everybody of what's out there at the Observer, what you got coming up, and how they can get it.
Mailbag out today. Dropped it a little early because we got some Auburn baseball tomorrow. So you can check out the Auburn baseball story tomorrow from our pal Henry Patton. Mailbag today. Talking Auburn offensive line, we got into some scheme stuff with Alex Golish and DJ Durkin as well that you can check out in there. Talked about some wide receivers, so a lot of good Auburn football stuff in there. Dan and I will record a podcast that'll drop this weekend as well. Deshaun Spencer breakdown, you can read that from earlier in the week. Also, a story on Auburn basketball's roster construction and the depth and just kind of how I see things shaking out positionally this year for them. That's all at the Observer, auburnobserver.com, $6 a month or $60 a year. You get that, and everything we do gets emailed to your inbox. So you subscribe tonight. You can check out everything we've got on the site now. You get that Auburn baseball story tomorrow. Get that podcast just for subscribers over the weekend as well.
Tons of stuff, no question about it, and it's absolutely amazing for the amount of info that you put out, Justin.
Highly recommend folks check out auburnobserver.com, and Henry doing great work with baseball coverage, not just today, but this weekend and the rest of the rest of the postseason.
He'll be there representing the Observer at regionals next week, and we'll see how far it goes.
Coach John Dunn should join us tomorrow. We're looking forward to checking in with him. We'll be talking about we'll be previewing the Auburn A&M game, or they move it up. We'll be talking about it while it's going on. But looking forward to that. Ferg, appreciate you being in. Always enjoy it.
Yes, sir.
That's going to wrap things up for the Thursday edition of The Drive. Once again, a reminder, no show this coming Monday for Memorial Day. But that will be the only day.